This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Chua Antik. Fur Kids Farm is a non-profit animal rescue center specializing in the rescue, rehabilitation, and rehoming of abused and injured animals. Founder Manju Apadre is on the show today to talk about her quest to build a shelter for the handicapped, mentally disabled, and elderly dogs who need a home. Also joining us is Dennis Lee, the treasurer of Fur Kids Farm. Welcome.
Hi.
So perhaps, Manju, I'll start with you. Tell us the story about how Fur Kids Farm started.
It actually started with me and my auntie. Actually, that's not quite true. It started with Ruff, my first boy. He was a puppy. And he's actually a golden. And he turned up at my auntie's gate. And this was at a point where I was very scared of animals. I dare not go near cats, dogs, nothing. I was very scared. So this guy turns up at the gate, and we could see that he was hurt. So we couldn't turn him away. So we opened the gate. He came in. And I remember, because I didn't know how to carry him. I've never handled an animal. I was like, oh my God, how do I lift this guy, you know? And so somehow or other, we got him into the house, and then we took him to a vet. And it was only then that we found out that he had injuries and, you know, there were signs of beating. So that was actually the first time. You know, it doesn't quite register with you that animals get tortured, that animals get beaten, until it actually quite happens to you, you know, because until that point, I never really noticed animals. You know, they were just a non-issue for me. So then we took Ruff in, and then he got better. He's a golden. After that, a mastiff mix girl turned up at our gate. And I didn't know anything about breeds at that time. Apparently, these are all very popular, you know, pedigree sort of breeds. But she was a mix. She turned up. And then a Rottweiler turned up at my gate. And then a Doberman turned up at my gate. And by this time, we were like, people were telling us, you know, we just posted in Facebook, you know, and our friends who had dogs, you know, told us, hey, you guys, these are all like breeds and stuff like that. And then we started searching. And then, you know, by the time the Doberman came, we were like, okay, universe, we get the message, you know, stop sending dogs. And we had four at that time. And we started actually in our own neighborhood. You know, we would go around just looking around to see if there's any injured animal. And we did come across quite a lot of cats and dogs that were beaten, that were starving, you know, that were abused by you know, boys on the street, things like that. And it was a very shocking thing for us. So we started posting about it on Facebook, on our personal page. We didn't have FKF, you know, it wasn't, we didn't have that idea yet at that point. And people started then calling in and telling us like, hey, you know, I saw this dog the other day. He had like this very open wound, you know, things like that. People started reporting to us. It was much later than that, actually after Dennis came on, that he started talking about, you know, why don't you guys actually make it legal, you know, so that then you can actually build a shelter to take care of them. Because at that point, we were getting more and more cases, and we didn't know what to do with these babies, you know, like where do we put them? So we actually had them in different places. You know, we scattered them all over the place with friends who would take them in. You know, it wasn't organized. So it was after that we started thinking along this way. And Fur Kids Farm, the name came because, you know, I actually see my cats and dogs as my babies. So, you know, Fur Kids was that. And the farm, because when I started thinking about a shelter, what I actually wanted was a place where they can run free, you know, because they've been abused and tortured. They've been through things that, you know, we humans would not survive, you know, but they've come out of those kind of situations. And I did not want to put them in canals, in cage, you know, I didn't want to do that to them. So I wanted a place where they can run free, you know, like a little heaven for them. So that's how Fur Kids Farm came about.
How long ago was when you met Ruff?
Ruff was, I think, how old is Ruff now? Five? Yeah, Ruff is about five now.
And he was a baby when he
disappeared. Yeah, he was a little guy. Yeah.
And how long did it take for the three other dogs to show up?
It was very close to each other. I think by the time we hit the fourth boy, Day, who's a Dobie, I think it was a year plus. You know, we hit them. We hit four dogs immediately. So it was Ruff, and then Tiff, and then Zaff, and then Day. So to get all those dogs within a year, and it wasn't us going out to look for them. You know, they were just turning up at the gate, you know, and it was just so weird.
It's like a sign.
Yeah, so.
So Dennis, coming to you, what is your involvement with Fur Kids Farm? How did you came to be involved with them?
I got to know Manju first, and subsequently, I got to know that she rescued animals. Over time, I started spending more time with her and got involved in the rescues as well. At some point, I asked her, since you are doing all this and you're spending so much effort on it, why not make it official? That's where she got the idea to launch FKF as an official NGO.
And you both are doing this full-time at the moment?
We were doing it full-time because at that time I was actually on study leave. I was actually pursuing my PhD. So after that, I had to go back to work. So now it's like all of us are doing it part-time, except for my auntie, because she actually gave up her career. And the house where the dogs turned up, we were actually supposed to renovate it. So we put everything on hold and the house became a temporary shelter. So she actually stopped working so that she can care for the animals full time.
You mentioned earlier that you would stake out a house to check whether the pets were abused. If you found out that they were abused, what would you do?
There are two ways we can handle the situation. One is that we try to get the animal into a public area. For example, there was one rescue that we did. The dog was beaten very badly and he was starved, so much so that he could walk out between the bars of the gate. That's how skinny he was. So we could actually lure him out. You know, we gave him food and he actually came out. And so we rescued him on a public road. You know, so that's okay. But of course, we follow every rescue that we do. We follow it with a police report. The other way that we can do is we are not able to get the animal out into a public area. We then have to make a police report first, go to the DVS with it, the Department of Veterinary Services with it, and then get their help to come in and rescue the animal, because we cannot go into a private premise, obviously.
I imagine the owners would not welcome this.
Well, for example, there was one that we rescued on a public place, and the person who actually complained to us was someone who knew the abuser, and they were actually afraid because the person who complained had a lot of daughters. So she actually got scared. So we made a complaint. She said, you know, please leave my name out of it. So we made a complaint. We took it to DVS. Of course, we couldn't pursue with the case because, you know, the person who complained was afraid. So, yeah, there are things like that. But generally, we try to avoid confronting the abuser ourselves, you know, because our aim is to get the animal out, which is why we do the stakeout. We try to collect evidence first. There was one that I did in a very remote place in Selangor, where we actually stayed there. I got there around 11 at night, and I was parked outside until around 3 in the morning. We did get quite a bit of video of the person abusing. The case couldn't go through for some other reasons, but that's how we try to get as much evidence as possible. And at the site where we rescue, we take pictures. You know, that's why we immediately send them to the vet as well, so the vet gives a report, because DVS does go to the vet and ask them for a report as well. So we try to gather all this evidence, and on our part, we try to avoid the confrontation. We let DVS deal with the legal part of the case.
Dennis, are all rescue missions as dramatic as Manju explained?
The boring ones are boring. The interesting ones can get very interesting. We've had cases where sometimes when we are trying to rescue an injured stray, and the thing about strays is they don't really trust people. It's very hard to get close to them. even though you're trying to help them, they don't realize it. So we've had cases where there's up to a dozen of us rescuers, and we are trying to isolate one single injured dog, and the guy just runs all over the neighborhood, and he's got twice the number of legs we do. He runs twice as fast. So it can be difficult. You see 12 people running after a dog, and the people staying there just wonder what the heck is going on.
Do you find yourself having to explain to the public what's going on?
Usually, no. You just get a lot of weird looks. Mm. Right. So once you learn to ignore that, yeah, that's fine.
My guests today are Manju Appadure, founder of Fur Kids Farm, and Dennis Lee, who is the treasurer. We'll talk more about what it takes to manage an animal shelter after the break. You're listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon, it's Live and Learn, and I'm Chua Antik. Manju Appadure and Dennis Lee are here to talk about Fur Kids Farm. Before the break, we've been talking about the founding, and you said that you were terrified of cats and dogs before this. Mm-hmm. Why were you terrified of cats and dogs? Was it from a childhood trauma?
Yeah, I was a little kid when my granny took me to her friend's house, and that person had a lot of cats, and I was okay with them. You know, we were playing, we were jumping across a little fence she had or something like that. At one point, they all turned on me and started scratching me. So I got a lot of scratches on my leg, and ever since then, I've been terrified of cats. Dogs, I guess it just followed, you know, cats and dogs, and I would never go near a dog. And I remember, like, walking back from school sometimes to home, I would actually take the longer route because I know that there's this particular neighbor who has a dog. It's behind the gate, but still I would take a longer route.
Well, things have not been easy for the both of you. Why did you not think about, when you were getting all those cases, when people were reporting to your Facebook page, why did you not think of maybe volunteering at an existing shelter?
Actually, it's not something I really thought so much about, you know, because I didn't know about animal shelters, you know. I knew SPCA existed somewhere, you know, but other than that, I really don't know much about shelters. And like I said, I didn't even know that animals got abused because generally the everyday person doesn't really give much thought to animals. I know because I was like that. You know, you go to work, you go to school, you come back, you have your own things. You hardly give a thought to animals. So it wasn't something I was thinking about, like, what do I do with them? And I didn't quite at that point understand how much work goes into it, you know, when I first started getting my first maybe 10, 20 cases, you know. So it was something I could handle. It was only much later that we, you know, when we started getting more serious cases, and then it was something that I couldn't let go of, you know. It's something that I thought about every day. I would, like, there were some cases that, you know, because we were such a small team, we couldn't take in every case, you know, and we didn't have a place to put them, you know. So there were some cases that we say no to. And I remember there was one case we didn't think it was serious. We let the case go. And later we found out that, you know, that girl died, that dog died. So things like that, that stays with you, you know, because you keep thinking, like, I should have done something. I could have done something, you know, and you feel kind of helpless, you know. And at that point, you think, like, you feel called upon, you yourself have to do something, you know. You can't just keep pushing the problem to other people, you know. There's something you got to do, you know. And we decided to focus specifically on abused and also severely injured, because that is, those cases take a lot out of you, you know. First of all, you rescue them, and that itself can be a little bit traumatic, because I remember when I rescued Rory, he actually, the owner beat him with a stick that had nails on it. So the guy was actually literally punched, you know, with holes all over his body. And I remember when I kept him in my bedroom because he needed that, you know, specific care. And I remember I had to put medicine into his wounds. And, you know, I was actually poking my finger into his body, you know. And I remember saying a prayer as I was doing it, you know. So you know, cases like that, they stay with you. And I feel that at some point, when we started focusing on abuse and severely injured, it takes a lot out of you to commit to that animal, you know, to see them through, you know. And I remember also there was another case. I was picking out maggots from the wound. The doctor had injected this liquid and the maggots were falling off, and I was picking up because the doctor was busy at that time. So, and then after that, there's that cost involved because they require surgery. They have other injuries, you know, because, like, for example, if they are starved and then, you know, there are other complications that happen, not necessarily physical injury. There are a lot of things going on inside the body that we come to know later. There's the element of cost. There's so many surgeries that they have to go through. And after that, you know, post-care, we've had babies who couldn't walk, you know, so we have to give them that physical, that therapy, you know, have to teach them how to walk. Like, for example, we need to get them to not fear people. Like Katie was a girl I rescued, and we actually call her Porcupine because as far as it is now, she was in a lot of pain because people had poked her with this steel rods. They were about a few inches long, and she had like about a dozen or so on her body. Somebody thought it would be funny to use her as a pincushion. So she was obviously very scared of anyone, you know. We have to heal her of that. So it takes a lot of time, a lot out of you to dedicate your time and yourself to that animal. So that's why we cannot afford to do strays as well. We just focus on abused and severely injured animals.
Dennis, all the surgeries and medical care does not come cheap. How much does it cost to keep the program up and running?
We average 2,000 to 3,000 in medical costs per rescue. Over the years that we've been doing this, we estimate we've spent more than 100,000 on medical expenses and also monthly upkeep.
What is the source of funding? Has donation been pouring in from the public?
No, we are mostly self-funded, which means that the expenses largely come from our own pockets. Easily 98% of expenses are from our own pockets. We only get a couple hundred in donations monthly.
Is this a conscious choice not to maybe crowdsource some of the funds?
It's not so much a conscious choice. We are having issues with fundraising because, in the first place, among the public, there is not much publicity for animal welfare. Most people who want to donate to charity go towards other causes such as single moms and orphanages. So animals in Malaysia are generally regarded as a second tier. Even for corporate sponsors, we have had such responses where they tell us that animals are not on the priority list. And another issue we are facing is that we do not have a permanent shelter up and running yet, at least not a legal official one. So we are facing a problem where when we talk to corporate sponsors, they are not willing to support us because we don't have that physical presence that they can have a look at.
On this point about the physical presence, Manju, before the interview in our correspondent, mm-hmm. you were telling me how you've had to rely on the kindness of strangers to lend their available land and also to open their homes to house some of the rescue animals who you just don't have enough space to put up in your own house. Has it been hard to find the spaces for 300 plus animals?
Yeah. It has been hard. There were times that, you know, I had to drive around with some of the babies in my car, you know. There were times, I remember once I parked my car to the side and I was sitting in my car and I was like screaming, you know, I just had to get it out of my system, you know. There were a lot of tears, you know, because I didn't know, I have all these babies with me. What do I do with them? Where do I take them? You know, it can be heart-wrenching. But we've been lucky. We found some places, you know, temple grounds, contractors who are not yet developing the land, you know, privately owned lands, people's homes, you know, but those are like one or two that we can put in one house. So things like that. We've managed to find people who can take them in. But right now, I think, luckily for us, we've managed to find land in Batu Arang. So it's about 2.5 acres of a piece of land. We've cleared it. We've done a very simple kind of fencing, not really a suitable fencing for shelter yet. But the thing now, as Dennis was saying, is one thing is getting the funding to build the structures, and secondly, to actually get someone to help us to build the structure. So these are the two main things that we need to push for this year. Because we need to move the animals in. The thing about having them in different places, you can't quite control how they are being looked after. You know, we can't be in all the places. You know, we've trained, and you know where they're in private homes, we ask help, and where they are in other places, we've gotten help from the locals there to help look after. But there's only so much you can expect from them, you know. And the ones that really need a lot of care, sometimes we cannot give them as much therapy or as much care as we would like to make sure that they make a full recovery. So that's why it's very critical for us to move to that place so we can provide that care, we can monitor, we can put them on a schedule, you know, we can have eyes on them 24/7. And also the thing is that that particular shelter not only will house the babies, it will also have the therapy place built into it, like the treadmill, the pool and everything built into it, because we cannot afford to take them every time, you know, because a lot of them need therapy. We cannot afford to take to a place where they can have therapy. So we need all those treadmills and everything there. So people that we have on site can literally give them that physio every day. So it should be a complete setup, especially for one like FKF, where we do have a lot of paralyzed, injured and traumatized animals with us.
Is putting up the rehabilitated animals up for adoption any part of the plan?
We do put a lot of animals up for adoption. I think partly because we are such a small team, sometimes we you know, half our time is gone with our job and then the other half with rescue. I think we don't have so much of a social presence online. You know, our Facebook is not often updated because we simply don't have the time to get to that. So I think people do not really know of all the cases. We've tried to find someone who can do that for us, but, you know, we've not been successful. Like I said, you know, it's like almost like not having a social life. You know, we have to actually plan and like, try to fit our social life because the shelter is priority. So I think once we have a better presence, I think people will know more about animals. But whenever we do an adoption drive, you know, we've done some at Taylor's University Lakeside Campus. We've done, I think, two there. Our animals are for adoption for free. Initially, we did it for free because we just wanted people to adopt them. Later, however, we started charging to cover the cost of the neutering, spaying, and the vaccination, so that, you know, to keep our cost low at least. However, we do have a process that we go through. We require them to sign an agreement with us. You know, it's like an adoption paper sort of agreement with us. Basically, that says, you know, they for a certain period of time, they have to keep us updated on how the animal is progressing. They will allow us to make at least two unscheduled visits to their place to check on the animal. If we feel that the animal is not being looked after, that they allow us to bring the animal back with us. We've done one case where we've taken the animal back with us. And also at any point in time, if the animal develops a sickness or an injury or it gets old and they no longer want the animal, that they will return it back to us and not give it out to another person, adopt it out to another person or put it down to sleep. That decision should not be theirs, that they will come back to us and at least let us know. I mean, there are some owners who are responsible, you know, they put it down for medical reasons. We can understand that. But there are a lot of people who also put it down just because, you know, it's old and ugly looking, so they say, you know, and that's not reason. Like we have with me now, one that I rescued is Wilbur. He's a very cute guy, but just because he was old, they actually just dumped him out on the highway. We rescued him off the highway, pretty starved, and the guy has cancer. So we're keeping him with us now. So we have a very stringent adoption process. That's only because we need to make sure that we're giving the animals out to good people.
Has the reception towards adoption been positive whenever you conduct these drives?
People are very sympathetic to the animals, you know, and they think they're cute and all that, you know. But I think people, a lot of cases, you know, it may not be true, but a lot of cases that we've come across, people would like to have all those pedigree. I mean, it's true that we do need to maintain the pedigree, but it's equally important that you adopt animals instead of buying from all these pet shops and all that. Granted, a lot of them have responsible breeders, but a lot of them do not. You don't know if your puppy is coming from puppy mill. So if you're not sure, you might as well not support the cause. You know, adopt is always a better idea. And the babies that we have are usually, you know, despite having gone through all the medical condition, they're usually more resilient. You know, they don't fall sick so easily. You know, the mongrels are more resilient that way. And they give you just as much care as any, you know, there's, when it comes to how much care your dog gives you or your cat gives you, there is no difference between a pedigree and a mongrel. So if you should adopt out of love, you see that that baby and you make a connection and then you adopt, you know. You shouldn't adopt for the wrong reasons, like, you know, you just want a dog to show off or, you know, you want it because everyone else has one. Those are, I think, the wrong reasons to adopt. You should adopt because you love. And then you won't have all these cases of people abandoning their pets, because we've come across a lot of cases where they just leave the pets out.
How do you cope emotionally? You spoke a little bit about it earlier in what you do, being exposed to all sorts of cases of abuse, abandonment. Mm-hmm. What has been the emotional cost of it? I'll come to you as well, Dennis, but maybe we'll start with Manju.
I think they kind of attach themselves to you, you know. Like, for example, Ruff, when I first got him, of course, I had no experience with animals. Ruff, at a point when he was very young, if he doesn't see me for like a week, you know, he doesn't eat. You know, he stops eating, you know, it gets lesser and lesser, and then he stops eating. So much so to the point where my auntie actually has to leave my old shirt or something with him, you know, that has my scent on it. So, you know, when they do these things, they kind of attach themselves to you, you know. And Wilbur has this thing now, because Wilbur is with me. I'll leave food out for him, and he actually waits until I get home before he sees me place, and then he goes and eats, you know. So they're kind of on your mind all the time. It's like, oh my God, like, what is he doing? Like, is he okay? And, you know, and even the ones that are far away, you know, you kind of keep thinking, like, you know, sometimes we cannot finish the therapy with the animal and we have to put it up with a foster. And you kind of keep thinking, you know, is he in pain? Will he be okay? I don't know what to say. I think they kind of just get to you, you know. They kind of sneak into your heart and they wrap themselves around your heart. And it's just,
Make everything worth it.
It's a happy thing, you know. It's heartbreaking when you're rescuing and you're seeing, but you know, when you see them recover from what they were to that happy, you know, lucky, happy-go-lucky kind of baby, and then after that they start torturing you back because, you know, they are so naughty and stuff like that, you know. But it's just so, makes you happy, you know, to see them go through all that. And I suppose I wouldn't be wrong in saying that it's the one thing that I think in life that they've saved me. You know, there were points in my life like I didn't know what was I going to do, you know, what would the next step be. You know, I was at crossroads. I think the babies actually saved me. and they gave me a purpose, they gave me a direction, and, you know, they give you so much love that you can't tear yourself away. You know, you kind of just get into it.
Dennis?
Back when I was younger, I always thought of charity as something that you do when you are retired. After you hit 50, you've got money, you quit your job, and then you start going to the Lions Club or whatever. Okay, and I think a lot of Malaysians share that same idea, whether consciously or unconsciously. Only after I came to know Manju and what she was doing, I started to realize that charity is not something that needs to wait. It can be something that you do now, today. Just devote a bit of time, a bit of resources. It doesn't matter if you're not a millionaire yet. I'm doing this because it's something good. It's something that needs to be done.
How can the public get in touch or contribute if they would like to? What kind of help do you need most?
We basically need a few things. Number one, of course, is always financial, because a lot of our costs are financial in nature. Medical costs are our biggest expense. We understand that sometimes there's concerns about giving money to charities. If the concern is there, they can contact us and make arrangements to donate directly to the vet, or by giving us items such as pet food and, at the moment, building materials for the shelter. Although, I would still recommend that, if possible, financial donations are more useful because, for example, we buy pet food at a significant discount, at half the price of what the pet shop is selling for. It makes more sense to donate cash.
With corporate sponsors, I think, because as an NGO, we are audited. You know, we make sure that, you know, legally we follow all the rules and regulations there are. I think the good thing with corporate sponsors, because we can give them the entire account statements and everything, so, you know, they are privy to everything that happens in the shelter. So I would say priority for us this year is to get funding to build a shelter and actually construct the shelter, because that is the getting the babies, to get them that 24/7 care is the main concern. That's one thing that always stays in my mind, because I'm always thinking, like, how is this baby and how's that baby and how is she doing, how's he doing, you know? So I just want to get them to one place where I know that they're getting the best that I can give them.
Is the Fur Kids Farm Facebook page the best place to reach both of you?
Yep, it has our Facebook page, Fur Kids Farm, as well as our phone number is also there, 010-900-4294. Those are the two best places to get us.
How long do you guys envision doing this for?
I want to do it to a point where there are no longer any abused animals. You know, we want to create that awareness, because just rescuing, it's a never-ending cycle. That's why we try to do a lot of, we try to do awareness programs to educate people on how to care for these babies. Even other people, you know, who walk past and see the animal being abused or see the animal injured, to do something about it, not just walk past the baby and just leave it there. You know, that awareness has to be there to see that animal and also think, you know, that that's a baby in need. You know, it needs your help, and it can't ask you for your help. You know, you need to look and see that is in pain and help it out, because it's the right thing to do, you know, not because you're going to get anything out of it, but because it's the right thing to do. Don't just walk past a baby in need. I think that awareness is important. So ideally, I would like to do it to a point where people are aware and we no longer have to rescue.
Dennis, final words?
Yeah, I don't see myself getting out of this anytime soon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having us.
I've been speaking to Manju Appaduri, founder of Fur Kids Farm, and Dennis Lee, the treasurer of Fur Kids Farm, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.